This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I am Brooke Spector, as always. And we are delighted, we really, really are delighted to have Paul Slavolevsky with us. In fact, we're sitting in my kitchen this morning over cups of really strong hot coffee. And we're talking with Paul, not simply because he is, in that dreadfully overused word, an iconic playwright and actor, but because one of his iconic plays is coming back on stage. And that, of course, is Saturday Night at the Palace, which goes back to very early years of being a playwright.
1982.
All right, which is before many listeners may well have been born.
Yeah.
We're doing this as a tag team duo. We're going to, the two of us are going to answer each other's sentences. In all seriousness, Paul is one of these playwright actor individuals. How do we say it? He found the South African zeitgeist almost. And mined it consistently over the years with plays like Saturday Night at the Palace, which to my mind is kind of a companion piece with Master Harold and the Boys by Ethel Thugard. There's some similarities and some serious differences, but the circumstances, the racial circumstances have mutual echoes. But the first play I saw by Paul was actually Moy Street Moves, which was right at the absolute dividing line between the perceptions of white South Africans about blacks and how they have to find some kind of modus vivendi in that maze.
Yes.
And they did, at some peril to one of the actor cast members' characters. Yes. But Saturday Night at the Palace is coming back to the Joburg Theater, 28 July through the end of August. So just a couple of weeks from now.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. Obviously, the original cast is not making a reappearance.
Well, two of us have left the planet.
Yeah, I was going to say, but it's not actually going to work well. But you have a good, interesting, strong cast.
Oh, very strong.
And tell me a little bit about them.
Okay, well, Charlie Bougnon. He's perfect for Vince. And look, he's a little old. I mean, both the two white guys are a little old. We were, Billy and I were younger, and it is written actually for slightly younger guys, but that's fine. It's in the, they're not 40 yet, so that's cool. And Samson Kumalo is now playing.
40 is the new childhood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For some of us.
And Samson Kumalo is playing September. So it's a very strong cast. I've known Samson many years. And it's great because he's a lot older than the guys. And there's this whole, this thing where they call him boy. You know, it's the old, you know, I keep telling people that it's an, I'm a bit nervous about the run, frankly, because, I mean, the K word is bandied about 40 times at least in the play. And I was concerned.
But that of course is of its time.
Of its time.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, of course, the U.S. is wrestling with this business really hard about whether or not in schools a theater director can do a play that involves a gay couple or a lesbian couple or use words that are now on the forbidden list or whatever.
Crazy.
And it's become really, really complex for people doing theater for young people.
Yeah.
But this play and many of the others that you did that are of that texture.
Yeah.
Well, they have to say what the characters have to say what they're going to say because it is the way people talk.
Yeah, in those days. It's an incident at a roadhouse that was inspired by a little article in the front page of the Star at the time, on the 8th of August, 81, in fact. That's when the article appeared. But I'd experienced that as a youngster playing soccer at Iskor van der Bale and going to roadhouses and witnessing what was going on and unable to do anything. And I had to write a play.
Witnessing the humiliation, the sort of almost unconscious humiliation of the wait staff
yep.
by 20-year-olds.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And nothing was done about it ever. Guys got away with it. And I could see the injustices, but was frustrated, unable to do anything. And so when the opportunity came for me to write, I mean, I had written a couple of things before, the defamation of Miles Cookamore and renovations, a couple of things I tried. But Palace was the first big, big hit. I mean, we ran it for 3 years.
I was going to say people went to it because it was, if it were an opera, it would have been that type of opera which mimics real life. People die horrible deaths and...
It was the newspaper of the day, actually. I think for a lot of people used to walk out and say, does this really happen? You know, the rector of the university, we played in the Free State in Bloemfontein, ran for 3 weeks, sold out, and we had people, white university rector getting up with 40 of his staff and storming out of the theater, shouting,
like something a success.
When
the audience vanishes.
Vanishes, yes. But also during, I mean, I've warned this cast now that they're going to get cries and shouts during the show. There's no question. Even back in 82, we had guys shouting, come right, come right. And, you know, really, come right. And I think we're going to get a lot more this time.
It's sort of audience participation theater.
Yes. And you know, that's why I laugh. You mentioned Master Harold. What was it? This kind of what, in inverted commas, tame little show, lovely look at of the society. And upstairs we were going mad with people vomiting during the show, storming across the stage to get out. Well, no, you know, not all the time. No, we had people coming there, but the reaction to some people. I mean, woman screaming and had to run from the theater. So we had some really amazing times.
Look, I can, on a different play, I mean, one that, you know, is a classic of a very different type. What's the play that takes place in Venice, the Shakespearean play?
Romeo and Juliet.
No.
Oh, sorry.
The one with the general and... Quick, help me out.
Coriolanus.
No. Oh, goodness. I'm now totally...
Okay, what happens in the play?
All right. You have the Moor who is the general.
Oh, it's Othello.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, Othello. Of course it is.
Yeah.
You notice what happens when you get past 70.
No.
Stuff goes out of your mind. When it first played in Johannesburg at the Market Theater with an actual real mixed cast.
Yeah.
And
John Connie
and Joanna Weinberg. And there was in act two, scene two, there's a kiss.
Yes.
And it wasn't just a peck on the cheek.
Yes, it was a full on.
And the audience wasn't just quiet. I wrote to friends at the time and said, you could hear crickets breathing.
Yes. Yes.
Because it was such, everybody held their breath like, what's going, will the sky collapse on us? This was like 1987.
Well, you know, Sandra Prinsloo and John Connie had the first kiss.
Yes.
Strindberg, or was it Miss Julie?
Yeah.
When the tires were let down outside and they punctured the tires and the artists are like...
Well, I mean, the point I guess I'm getting at is that your work in particular is such a theatrical, realistic slice of life.
Yeah.
Right down to the way in which you make use of language, the way in which you channel the mental processes of the participants in the drama, that your audience is drawn deeper and deeper into this labyrinth.
Mm. It's interesting because I've just finished last week trying to get some more plays published. This is a tragedy of South Africa. I've written 38 plays and only 7 of them are published.
There should be a uniform national process. This has bugged me for years.
Oh, it's crazy.
It's not just plays, but it's all the major novels and short stories by authors. You can't find uniform editions by any of these people.
It's terrible. It took Making Like America because I'd lost the ending. Those are the days of the market when you didn't have laptops and your computers broke down in there. And so I found scraps of paper that we were writing in the final week. But so, anyway, I've put the whole thing together again and I just finished it last week. And Making Like America is the same kind of play. These guys planning a robbery and the language in the play and the stuff that happens when the mother comes tottering through and says, is it Mandela? You know, there's the cops are outside and she thinks it's Mandela. And I laughed as I was doing it last week. I thought, gosh, that's how long ago it was. It was pre-1986. And that's the same thing, the same real picture of what is happening in South Africa at the time.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I mean, your work, in my mind, divides into two halves. There are these kinds of plays.
Yes.
And then there are the, if you were Australian, the mateship plays.
Yes, yes, yes.
The kinds of things you would do with Bill Flynn and sometimes turned into films.
Yes.
There's tragedy in them in some way, but it's not this raw edge of racial positioning.
Yeah, things have changed. Well, I mean, look, my career has straddled almost perfectly pre-democracy, you know, the bad old days and the free, new, democratic South Africa. And it's interesting that the tone, like in Suddenly the Storm, yeah. It's such a different play.
That's a newer play,
yeah.
In which an older man has to confront activities of his youth.
Yes. And
putting it gently, I guess.
Yeah. We had a black woman, they had a child, and he didn't know about the child. But it's the same South Africa, but we're looking at it through a different lens now, you know?
And there are people who might say that, oh, well, you're just another one of these white playwrights who's writing about the white experience for white audience members. I think that's a ridiculously unfair criticism, but you hear it every once in a while.
Mm. Well, you know, it's interesting. In fact, James Noble was looking to do it again. When I did Hole in One, mm-hmm. which was the caddy and the two white golfers.
Yeah.
I had the caddy, James, he spoke to the audience. The other two were just part of the play, but he spoke to the audience. And I'll never forget, it was the first time that Daphne Koon had had black audiences coming to Theatre on the Square. And this was 2004. And not one or two, but dozens. And it was...
James has a following.
Yeah, he has a following. But also the things he was saying about the relationship between, you know, how this caddy, how he was treated by the... And so he spoke to the audience and talking about... And so, yeah, I mean, I do often tell the right plays from the white perspective, but I have had enough experience with... I have a lot of black characters in my play now. In fact, more and more, you know.
As you evolve a play... As you, I mean, I know you don't just sit down and write it one afternoon. Here's a play. Boom, boom, boom.
It'll take a long time. Yeah.
It's got to be digested. It has to gestate. It has to, you have false starts.
Yeah.
And there are pages on the floor that are going to go into the trash bin.
Yeah. My making like America Pile is that big longhand notes and yeah.
But how do you find that vein of truth talk? How do you know it's there?
Are you talking about the dialogue or what they're talking about?
Both.
Both. Okay.
Dialogue may be easier because you've got such experience in crafting dialogue.
Yes. And also it's listening. You know, I run a workshop. I do a masterclass. I call it the storytelling masterclass and it's for film and television and plays, starting with plays, obviously plays because that's my first love. And I always, one of the things it's the listening part. And they're doing the research and going to places that people don't normally go. And also just, I'm not wearing it now, but I often wear my Orlando Pirates top all over because it's my icebreaker calling card.
Unless they're
Chiefs.
Yeah.
But then there's an argument. No, but you see, even that sets off something because they go, you're the wrong, you know. So, and that came about.
Or Morocco Swallows even at this point.
Yeah, Morocco Swallows. And that was my story. I always tell that story because that's how I wrote Moy Street Moves. Moy Street Moves, which you talk about, I was filming in Hillbrow and happened to be wearing, this is 1990.
We have to take an ad break. The piper must be paid.
Oh, okay.
And we will be right back. I'm speaking to Paul Slavolepsky. This is Brooke Spector at The Deep Dive. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we're back again with Paul Slavolepsky, playwright, social thinker, conscience of South Africa's past, present, and perhaps its future. And I stopped him right in the middle of a story, which I hope he has not forgotten.
Yeah.
But continue.
Okay. So it's Moisture Moon. I was filming in Hillbrow and it was a break in filming with Marnie von Rensburg, who sadly left us now, but wonderful director. And he said, go off. You got an hour. And I walked right up into the depths of Hillbrow. Look, it was 1990, but anyway. And I was wearing my Orlando Pirates t-shirt. And I started this conversation with this guy. And I'd seen these chaps coming out of the building with chunks of meat, blood dropping to the ground. And it was pitch black inside. There was no lights or anything. It was a building. Cumberland Mansions with all half the letters were missing. And he pulled me, because we've been talking about soccer. He grabbed me and pulled me inside. And we trusted each other, both Pirates fans. And on the back steps, on the metal steps, there was an informal abattoir. Butchery, chopping up a sheep and selling off the pieces. And I thought, gosh, there's a player here. So that was, for me, the introduction. So he didn't tell me what was happening in the building. There's a godfather who runs this building. No one pays rent. He comes around with a bicycle spoke, and he stands close to you. And if you don't pay, it slips between your ribs. I got all the stories. So you see...
I'm laughing, but it's horrifying.
It's horrifying, yes. And then you learn how the whole thing works. You pay an extortion and it doesn't even own the building. And then I spend time talking to these guys and then players emerge. And
you were filming Taxi to Soweto.
That's right.
Which is my favorite South African film.
Oh gosh.
And I remember your part. You were the desk clerk manager of a truly scurrilous hotel.
That's what we were filming the day I walked up.
And you had a pistol that was about the size of an assault rifle.
That's right. You know, I was supposed to help Marnie on that bloody film. It's a long story. I've got a whole story about that. I'll tell you one day, because I was helping him write the thing. But he had a girlfriend who changed things. She was completely insane. But anyway, that's another story. No, she kept coming with ridiculous ideas and,
there we are in the Stygian depths with a guy with a sharpened bicycle spoke in the informal abattoirs. People walk out with chunks of a cow.
Or of sheep. I think it was chopping up a sheep on the back steps. And it was right in the courtyard at the back. And then you had to go through the building out into the back courtyard. The building had already been hijacked. And that was 1990 really. But it was fascinating. And then you learn the whole politics of the thing. And then, of course, when I wrote the play and worked with Siputla Sibugodi, he, of course, also knows of that whole thing, you know, how the whole thing works. So he fitted in very quickly and easily. And it was...
What I liked about My Street Moves, and I only thought about it later, it's the transformation. It's the passing on of knowledge.
Yeah.
Without giving up the whole story.
Yeah.
White guy comes from the boondocks. He's looking for his brother who supposedly is in business, but is actually fencing stolen goods.
Yeah.
And his brother's partner is now this black guy who has essentially taken over the business of fencing stolen goods and now has to pass on the knowledge to the brother, the new naive brother.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's that. There's a moment of shock recognition when all the pieces, you know, and you go, got it. Yeah. Okay. I now see how this is
working. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, the life of a play. It was done about 2014 in Pretoria at the State Theatre because Theo Landy played that Martin's part and he told me to come and watch it. And, it was amazing. A full black audience. So about 300. There were three white people in the audience. Myself and two other Victoria people. And it was black audience. And it went down incredibly well. And I thought, gosh, I wrote that in 1991. And 2014, it's still as echoes.
That is our house cat, by the way. She wants to go either out or be the center of attention. We haven't quite figured out what she wants yet. And we're going to let that ride for a bit. We're speaking with Paul Slavolevsky, playwright, social thinker, commentator about the universe. But we're speaking in particular about the fact that one of his classics, Saturday Night at the Palace, is opening shortly at the Joburg Theater with obviously a new cast.
Yep.
But the play hasn't changed. You didn't rewrite anything.
I've not changed anything at all. Left it. I think, you know, it's important that it's a play of its time. I mean, it's kind of a bit, not that I said flawed, but I can see the holes in the play. I was a very young playwright and certain kind of naivety. I don't know. The language is fine. The dialogue's fine, but the structure of the play is not. I could rewrite that play today, like I've done with Making Like a Merrick. I haven't changed much of it other than a few things in the play that were lacking, you know, back at the time. But I'd never touch Palace because it is a kind of a snapshot of the time, an incident at a roadhouse, and I describe it almost exactly as it would happen.
And if you changed it, then the whole ethos of the thing wouldn't be the way the world was.
Mm. Absolutely. People get, they're kind of shocked at, then what we got at the time, all of us, the cast members, would go down and meet members of the audience afterwards, and they'd say to us, but does this really happen? Surely this couldn't happen. And I couldn't believe that people lived in such a bubble. I'm talking about the white population at the time. I mean, that's in Bloemfontein. I mean, the rector of the university standing up screaming, lies, you know, lies. Lies! Lies! Stop this! Stop! Stop! They wanted the,
surprised they didn't take you out and pour.
Yeah.
Tar and feathers all over.
Yeah, they can. I mean, we used to come down and I used to say, spot the security police. You know, by the time the government woke up to Palace, 20,000 people had seen it. And Peter Dirk.
It's kind of hard to close it.
Close it after that. Peter Dirk, I said to me, he says, you are so lucky you did not write this in Afrikaans. It would have been banned the next night.
Well, Peter Dirk has said that in many cases, plays didn't write them out because if you wrote them out, then it has to go to the censor board.
Yeah.
But if you didn't write it out, then they couldn't censor anything because there wasn't anything to work with.
Yeah.
It was just whatever there was on the stage at the time.
Yeah. And I remember the bad language. I mean, if I'd been an Afrikaner and used that language, it was, I mean, even the one, I remember the Die Vaderland, all of the reviews were raves. For Palace. But the Vaderland, the headline was bad language Mars play, you know, and you think, well, that's all they're worried about. It's this terrible language they were using. It was like, not accepting the fact that this is exactly how the people talk and this is what happened. It was just they were worried about the bad language.
I mean, another one of your classics is Elvis Duplessani.
Yeah.
And it's basically just an extended monologue for however long it runs.
Yeah. 80 minutes.
And that's full of language that is descriptive.
In fact, we're going to do it again next year. I think Ashley Dowd is going to do it. Peter Tureen called me and asked me. And I said, yes, let him do it. Think around. But I'm also going to keep that as a period play because...
Don't change it.
Not going to change it.
No, don't change it. Don't change a fingernail.
Good. Or people always say, oh, you're going to update things. Plays are written for the time, you know. I mean, I really want to do Making Like America again because it's this robbery that goes wrong. I mean, you also Making Like Marius Bayer's.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Marius all right. Playing the brother who comes and they've got this perfect robbery and it all falls apart.
As it should. Otherwise, there's no play.
Yeah.
If it goes swimmingly, they make $1 million, they go away, and everybody's happy.
Yeah.
The people who lost their money.
Yeah.
No, it's
a lovely play. I mean, I'm just wallowing in the, in fact, I'm going to get it done with Daniel Newton, is Lionel Newton and Laura Foote's son. Want him to play the part I played. So we'll see.
Yeah. You're now in the position of handing off parts that you created, characters that are extensions of you in some way.
Yeah.
And you're handing them off to generation new.
Coming up,
To do this. One thing I wanted to ask you, given your own family background, your father was a hero of World War II, worked for the Polish Air Force in exile, effectively in Britain, flying Spitfires?
Spitfires, yeah, the Spitfire,
To the best of my knowledge, you never mind any of that as a thing, reach back into that heritage.
No, my dad started writing memoirs. It's not long. It's only, I don't know, a couple of hundred, 100 pages long, actually. It's something, it was just the first part of the war he describes and things that happened. So, you know, and also didn't talk much about it. I mean, it was he was tortured. It was a terrible ordeal.
World War II veterans don't usually talk about it. I never found anything out like the last minutes.
Yeah. Now in Romania, he'd be captured and escaped and his colleague was shot on the barbed wire next to him. All long stories. But so he was affected. My dad was, in a sense, war damaged, in a sense, psychologically. I mean, he was a great father, but there were times when it was rough. But you see, I don't know enough of that to write about. I can only write of my experiences. I mean, in Elvis, I've got this father. It's not my dad, but there's a bit there of the damage that war creates. Yeah, I deal with stuff that I've experienced.
No, I just wondered because there's actually there's at least one film that I've seen about Polish pilots who ended up same route through from Poland to Romania, Romania to Greece, Greece to England, join up, get trained in British planes.
Yeah, that's right.
And pick up English in the process.
Yeah. Oh, no, that whole period, because my mum told me the stories of meeting him in Blackpool. They have a pass, a weekend pass or something. Even during the war that happened, because they had to break away from what was going on. And that's where they met. So they met quite early on in the war and only got married afterwards. So, I know a few things.
No, I've always wondered because, that seems like it's such a rich storyline, but you have to have.
Look, I'm writing memoirs. Gee, there again, I've got no time. I've just saying, guys give these people $2 million to write a book on Mbeki and the book doesn't go out and I struggle to.
Or 13 million to write a book on.
Oh yes.
Mashaba,
30 million. And,
that's a lot of small change.
If someone gave me some bucks, I'd write my memoir. If everyone's saying, you write about your life story in this theater. I mean, I've got tons of incredible stories.
Because your storyline starts at the Space Theater. And as the circumstances move to the beginnings of the Market Theater, before the beginning, really.
Before the beginning.
Barney Simon's The Company.
That's right, working at Witz Nunnery.
In that very large, expansive space, the Nunnery. And then independently moving on and finding other and more elaborate venues and other circumstances, and then film.
Yeah, film and... I know the whole story. I mean, I started UCT Drama School. I mean, I wasn't going to be involved in theater at all. I just fell in love.
You were supposed to be an engineer.
Engineer, that's right. That's right.
Not a train driver, an engineer.
Engineer, a proper engineer. And I convinced my dad that if I did a BA first, I could go on to that. Of course,
he believed you, didn't he?
He said, because he was big on studying, because anyone went to university and stuff. So you go to university and you do this. So anything to start off with. He said, start with that, but then you'll be an engineer afterwards. Well, by the time I'd got rolling, that was it, I was going to be a actor playwright.
It's hard being a freelance actor playwright. I mean, you are your own manager, but you have to look over the abyss all the time.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the thing of my 40 years with Billy. I mean, I was going to write a book just on me and Billy called Flying with Flynn. We met 18 years of age at UCT Drama School and he died age 58. So it's exactly 40 years. And, he was my partner in a sense that if ever we ran dry or we weren't getting other gigs, he just said, come on, Council of War, what are we doing? I said, okay, I'll write a play. And then I'd start. And so I wrote Palace for Billy. In fact, I wrote Making Like America for Billy, but he couldn't do it. My Low Fat Almost Italian Wedding, which started off as Victoria Almost Falls. I rewrote it then as My Low Fat. And Billy, the character there. So I kept writing stuff for the two of us to do. And we had terrible times, as a freelance actor in South Africa, playwright, you're doomed. And,
except for very few people.
Well,
All three of them.
Yes, all three of them. And then, when the World Cup was coming, the Rugby World Cup, I said to Bill, I'm writing an all out, full on comedy farce. And I mean, that put my three children to university. If it hadn't been for Heel Against the Head.
I was going to say that was a money spinner.
That was the money spinner. We printed money. In fact, our biggest mistake, and that's because we were tired, but we were silly. We should have taken a break. Is that we paid the Civic, which is the Joburg Theatre, 1,000 seater, chock a block every night for 4 weeks. And Billy and I were the producers. So we were printing money. But the point is, though, the one night when he said, there's three seats empty, we're actually, we're doomed. The three seats empty. We're going downhill. I think we must look at something else. I always laugh about that, you know.
Yeah, well, those three people were in the intensive care unit. Someone there was like, yeah. A terrible illness. Yeah. They couldn't drag themselves from the hospital. Yeah.
But the thing is though, because then straight after that, it's funny how after that it went back to nose to the coal face again and struggling. But those 3 years of Heel Against the Head put my kids to university. So I'm thankful for that.
We're going to take another break, and we're speaking with one of my favorite theatrical personalities, creative persons, actor, playwright, people, Paul Slavolevsky, one of his best known plays, coming back to the Joburg Theater. Soon, later on. End of this month.
3 weeks' time, I think.
Saturday night at the Palace. This is The Deep Dive, Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we're back again in my kitchen, actually, having a cup of coffee as our cat tries to join the conversation. We just chucked her out. I'm speaking with Paul Slavolevsky, playwright, actor, thinker about things in theater, and thinking about the way in which theater not just mimics life, but influences and acts on people so that, for example, Moy Street Moves, Saturday Night at the Palace, some of your other work, Soon the Storm, forces people to confront some aspect of a society in change. And if you're lucky, to rethink in some way their feeling about what they think, maybe things they hadn't even thought about before.
Yeah. Yes, look, for me, I heard this somewhere once, someone saying that...
That's okay, you're allowed to quote people.
Quote to people, yes, that theater is humankind's conversation with itself. That's what theater is. And I think that's why, for me, it's favorite. I love it above movies, television.
That sounds like a Barney Simon thing, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But I mean, it is, you know, it's the place you go to hear the stories, it gives you the words to speak. Theater gives you a voice because you see and hear other people's stories, and if there's a connection, you feel it on a visceral, on a cellular level. There's a connection. I believe there's some guy in America who did a test. He tested this whole thing that when an audience is watching a really powerful piece, like say a Arthur Miller Crucible or Death of a Salesman or whatever, all the heartbeats are in unison or something. It's all, there's something that happens.
Okay. People start to breathe together.
And the hearts beat together.
I had never thought of that, but that makes perfect sense.
No, they've done a test. Yeah. And you see, it's this connection that you only get in live theater because stories connect. Stories really connect. That's why people love to hear stories around a campfire, you know.
Well, humanity begins with tell me a story around the campfire. Yep. Tell me about the gods and goddesses and how we got to where we are.
Yeah. And they'll always be hungry for that. And that's why, you know, when people say, oh, theater's dying and stuff, it's nonsense. It may go through dips and troughs and stuff like that, but it always comes back because we need that connection. We need the story being told a story once upon a time. And also recognition. Oh, that's my uncle. That's my aunt. That's so-and-so, you know.
I know him.
I know him, yeah. And they've got through this, have they? Or they haven't got through it. Oh, gosh. You know, it makes you think about things and also gives you permission to grieve about things or to be happy about things. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I think the biggest most terrifying thing on earth would be to be in solitary confinement or something, or not in a place where you could hear stories because
you'd have to write your memoir.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you talk about Barney Sutton. Yeah. Barney's home. Yeah, that's the only place I'd probably be able to do it.
Well, you get free meals, room and board.
Yes, and then you just get on with it.
Just get right, scratch it onto the wall.
And- yeah. But Barney Simon always said one of my favorite things that Barney told me, because Barney, I mean, I would never have been a playwright if it hadn't been for Barney Simon. He gave me the courage. I mean, he used to gather people together and do workshop plays. And I used to say, oh, Barney, I've written this. And then he'd say, write further, write more. And I said, so who's going to want to know my stories, you know? And he just kept forcing it out of me. He insisted. And he gave me the courage. And I would never have done it without Barney. But one of my favorite things that he said was that there's a Yiddish proverb that God created humankind because he loved to hear stories. And I mean, I go with that. I mean,
that's sort of an inversion of the usual thought about gods and stories and humans.
Oh yeah.
You know, the idea, I mean, humans are telling stories about the gods rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I've never forgotten that.
That's nice. I wish I'd heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. Yiddish proverb.
And it's like,
you can look it up. God created mankind to hear stories, because he loved to hear stories. He loved to hear stories.
Well, he was one of those people. I didn't know him real well.
Yeah.
Because I was not sufficiently theatrical I guess I wasn't serious enough, but I do remember hearing about him sending off people to go, for example, to go spend time with homeless people on the street,
mm-hmm.
not just for an hour or two, but you know, come back next week.
Yeah.
After you've picked up the texture of it, the feel.
Yeah, spend as much time as you need to get their story. I don't know, Barney did that all the time, is to send us off to go and do things. Yeah, it was, he wanted the stories from out there. He wanted the stories from, I mean, that's Cincinnati is one example, the nightclub where people used to gather clandestine, you know, evenings, and then they'd pay the street cleaner. He'd come in and sweep and stuff, and he'd be the warner. He'd always be outside warning them, oh, the cops are coming. And he'd run inside and tell them the cops are coming. So Barney loved all sorts of stories, you know. That got me started.
Were there moments of self-doubt? I can't do this anymore. I've been cranking these things out for years. Maybe I should just go off and be at the beach.
No. I've got my little 1951 Modderfontein Dynamite Factory Nursery School report, and I've still got it. It's been eaten by termites, and often take it out when I do my master classes and wave it about. And it says, Paul, it's got the whole thing about how much I weighed and what I did. And at the end of it, it says, Paul stood in a box this morning, one morning, and entertained the whole nursery school. He was the funny man and entertained the owner. Now I was 3 and a half. So since the age of 3 and a half, I've been telling stories. When I was in Messina, it was on under a baobab tree at break, I just start telling stories and acting all the characters. So I've always told stories and always will tell stories. And I think it's because I'm interested in anything that's going on and I hear something interesting. And then I want to kind of pursue it and go, oh, what's going on there? You know, I mean, like for example, I took some trolley men now. I've got a whole thing going. In fact, it's going to be a movie. It's called Trolley Man. And, I meet the odd trolley man and have a conversation with some of these guys.
Trolley man is in the guys pushing the trash.
Pushing the trash bins around. They go to all the bins and some of them are different guys, highly intelligent. There's some guys who, you know, real on the bones. Well, most of them on the bones of their asses, but some guys have stories to tell. And so I've got this movie that I'm writing, and it's based on Trolley Man's experiences. And yes, that's great. You know, it kind of never stops. I just love hearing stories. And also one of the things I tell that I think Barney also, something that Barney told me, if you want to, and that's why I also wear my pirate thing all the time. If you want a story from someone, tell them a story. And 9 times out of 10, they will tell a story to you. And it works.
It's fair trade. You treat people equally.
Yeah. And also, you know, you meet someone and you talk about something. You make a connection, in other words. That's also, it's a connection, really.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, as you know, and we're speaking with Paul Slavolevsky, playwright, examiner of the human condition. thinker of deep thoughts. And we're also noting the fact that one of his early and best known plays, Saturday Night at the Palace, opens again at the Joburg Theater in just a few weeks. And I, you know, among other things, I would tell listeners to absolutely positively make an effort and go see it.
Yeah.
Or twice, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we're back with Paul Slavolevsky with time for some final thoughts about the condition of theater and what happens next and what should we look for and why should we look for it.
Okay, well, geez, interesting. I don't know why I'm thinking about it. I mean, now I'm rehearsing a play right now for the Hilton Festival that starts, well, it's in the mid-August. It's Annie Robinson Greeley. I've written a play called Finding Rosetta, and it's all about Elizabeth Clara, who was a South African woman, probably the most famous person on earth, who claims to have, well, in the UFO field, she claims to have met an alien way back in the mid-50s, child with an alien, and wrote a book about it called Beyond the Light Barrier. And so, that's a long story. I can't go starting about now. But anyway, I'm writing this play for Annie. Well, I've written it, and we're rehearsing at the moment. And we open at Hilton in, well, mid-August.
So you're going to have two plays going on at the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's an extraordinary achievement for a South African playwright.
It's crazy at the moment. I'm just going guns. You know, we're looking to take Suddenly the Storm to Copenhagen next year. We're in the process now of trying to organize that whole thing. So I'm working harder now than I was when I was 25. So it's crazy.
Well, now, you know, the clock ticks and every moment now matters.
Yeah. But I'm 75 now, so I need you.
Well, I mean, what happens to me? I go to see a film or a play and and I go, I'm never going to get that 2 hours back again.
Oh, yeah.
What am I going to do?
Yeah, you're going to see. Yeah.
So we've tended to become a little more selective about things, unless we have somebody steal my 2 hours yet again. Yeah. Paul, if you had to sum up your thing, dramatic career in a sentence, what would you, I mean, that's an impossible thing. I know that, but what would you call it? How would you describe it?
Well,
easy question.
Yes. Well, I'd call it a, when I talk about swings and roundabouts, it feels like a ride on a carousel, up and down. But I'm having a great time doing it. So that's the best way to describe it because I've had some rough times.
Yeah. But you look like a man who, if not totally in charge of things, is enjoying the ride that you're getting.
Oh, yes. I always have, even through the hard stuff. I wouldn't change it at all for anything. I had a lot of friends who said, why didn't you go overseas? Why didn't you go to England? And not for me. My stories come from this heartland, and I'll always be a South African storyteller. That's what I love.
We have been speaking with Paul Slavolevsky, playwright, actor, storyteller, man who finds the truth and illuminates it and lets us know, and we get to look at it, and we get to go, oh boy, I'm glad I'm not him. Some of those characters, they're wonderful. But do go see his old new play, the Joburg Theater, Saturday Night at the Palace. It's a piece of history, and I suspect it's also a piece of our present.
Yeah. Oh, this stuff happens today. And you know, that's the thing. It's like this racism, when will it end? When will we get, start getting a hold on it? And I think it's an important play, even though it takes place way back in 1982.
You said it, and I'll agree with you. It is an important play. Listeners have to go see it. This is Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week with another exploration with someone who has something interesting, thoughtful, useful, and important to say.